Call the meeting to order, please. The invocation today will be given by Chaplain Pollock of Fort Wainwright. Please remain seated.
Let us pray. We've come together to learn about and work for the betterment of our community. For this organization and its continued efforts, we give thee thanks and pray thy blessings upon them. Let each one of us rededicate ourselves to not only the improvement of this community, our state of Alaska, but our nation. In these troubled times, we ask thy kindness and blessing upon us. Be with us in Christ's name. Amen.
Thank you, Jeff. This time we have introduction of guests. We'll start with the table on my right, Jack.
Yes, Tom, Dad. Yes, first of all, Bert Carlson, Hillcrest Incorporated Manager. And my boss, Frank, is GA Manager for State Farm of Alaska.
Welcome. Al, you have any guests at your table? Okay. Don? No guest? I don't see any unfamiliar faces at the first table. Frank, any guests at your table? Richard, any guests at the back table? Almost got it. This time we'll have the manager's report from Wally.
We're working on the public address system. Hopefully we'll get the hum out of here. I have the management working on it, and if that doesn't work, we'll apply to the Fairbanks Inn for assistance. Before I get into my remarks, we do have a distinguished guest with us here today, one I'd like to introduce, because we should all admire the man for his courage. We all admire him for the effort that he's making, something that more of us should do. He's dedicating his time. He's a candidate for the city council, and I think he should be recognized, Jim Raleigh. Now for my report. We have the Chamber of Commerce has been very active in the last couple of weeks working on the impact problems that we hope to have as a part of the pipeline project. I say we hope to have them because it's a problem that represents an opportunity for us, and that's the type of thing that we like here. We're going to have the impact, and we're now working on how to handle it, how to cope with it, both on the city and borough level and state level, and from the attitude and of the businessman, the business community generally. We've been working very closely with all departments of government on this and with our legislators. And when the legislature convenes tomorrow in Juneau, we will be there and we will see that everything is done to try and make this transition, the impact, as graceful and as easy as possible on Fairbanks and on the community. I think that we will be able to do some good in this regard and help soften that impact. In that regard, our legislative committee will be meeting Thursday noon at the Chamber of Commerce. And any of you who are interested are more than welcome to attend. We urge you to attend and give us your input on what you feel should be done in the legislature as well as otherwise around the city. And the legislative committee is an excellent place to be working at this particular time. Be meeting Thursday noon at the Chamber. They have box lunches, so call the girls at the Chamber if you can be there, and we'll have a lunch for you, and you can help participate in the activities. Tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock, the Retail Trades Committee will meet here at the Chamber, or at the Travelers Inn. 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, the Retail Trades. One of the things that they'll be taking up tomorrow morning is a subject they've been working on for the last several months, is the new sales tax ordinance. any of you who are interested in that and would care to participate, you're more than welcome to attend the Retail Trades Committee meeting tomorrow morning here at the Travelers, 7 o'clock. The Chamber of Commerce is also sponsoring a joint meeting with the Valdez Chamber of Commerce. We'd like very much to have as good a participation from the general membership as possible. The Board of Directors will be represented, and the membership and the board from Valdez will be represented. But we'd like to have as many people go with us. We're going to go to Valdez and meet with them there in the end of the first week in November, probably the 7th through the 9th of November. So if you can make the trip with us, let us know. We'd like to have a good representation. Our working relationship with Valdez has always been good in the past and is going to be more important than ever in the future. They're tied in directly with the pipeline activity with us, and they need our help and we need them. So we're going down to see what we can do and start working together on this problem first week in November. So keep that in mind, and if you can possibly make it, let us know, and we'll be glad to make arrangements to have you go with us. And finally, on the 23rd, a week from today, we will not have a membership luncheon. This is the date of our annual meeting. Membership meeting will be Tuesday night next week on the 23rd. We'll be here in the Travelers Inn, 23rd in the evening. It's our annual meeting for installation of new officers, honoring the old officers, and making awards for special services throughout the year. We ask you to all plan on attending that meeting. It's going to be an exceptionally fine meeting, I feel. Our principal speaker will be the new president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, Jim Campbell from Anchorage. Jim will bring us a message of cooperation on the part of chambers throughout the state and the state chamber with the various chambers. I know he has something that we'll all be glad to hear. And so in addition to installing and honoring your new officers, you'll hear a message of real importance and of real interest. That's a week from tonight, October 23rd. I'll let the girls at the chamber know. We'll be expecting you. Also, on this Thursday, the 18th, it's Alaska Day. The chamber will be closed on that day, but we will be open for the legislative luncheon, so don't hesitate to come. Although the chamber will be closed during the balance of the day, we'll be there and expect you at noon for the legislative meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Wally. Can you hear okay above the hum? Is it? It's no problem? I'd like to just urge each of you to get involved in your chamber. The legislative committee has some very important things under consideration dealing with the governor's package, and we need the input from the business community, and I'd like to encourage you to attend or join in and work on the legislative committee. And we'll be meeting this Thursday. This time I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, Arlen Tusing, Professor of Economics at the Institute of Social and Economic Government Research. Arlen is presently on leave from a concurrent position as staff economist with the U.S. Senate Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs and as chief economist for the National Fuels and Energy Policy Study Group of the United States Senate. One of Alaska's foremost economists, Arlen has been closely associated with oil, gas, and pipeline developments in Alaska for several years. Arlen?
I had a story about Ted Agnew, and I don't think it's appropriate now, but in a sense, I owe my ability to meet this date to the former vice president. The Senate had decided to recess for 2.5 weeks to let the House catch up with its business, and only the resignation of Agnew was changed the schedule, so I was able to make it. It's something I think that Ted Agnew has played an important role in the pipeline developments twice, and I'll mention this in a minute. The last time I spoke to this group was in the summer of 1970. And if I remember correctly, my main topic then was the reason why the construction of the pipeline was not likely to start for several years. And again, if I remember correctly, I don't think many of you liked what I had to say then. And I'm fortunate that we don't have the custom that one of the ancient kings had, killing the messenger who brought bad news. I'm not here today to predict more long delays, and I'm not going to perform like some members of our congressional delegation either and make optimistic predictions every other day. But when I did accept this date, I had hoped to be able to report to you on the pipeline bill reported by the House Senate Conference Committee and give some notion of what the timetable would be, what the probability of future litigation would be. But as you know, we still don't have that bill. And as you may not know, it was only the resignation of Vice President Agnew that preserved the possibility of having a bill at all this year. The progress of the conference committee had been so slow and so bogged down in trivialities that if the Senate had recessed as it intended to, there's a good chance that the thing that might not have been put together for the rest of the year. That is, Congress would have gone back and found other legislation much more urgent, and the whole report would have been put over till January of 74. But it looks now as if we will have a good chance to get a bill out, and I'm not going to make any speculations on when the bill will be reported or what will happen after it is. Your guesses on these matters are probably as good as mine, and a little inside information is no substitute for just a good flip of the coin with respect to timing. Well, my talk today is not really about the pipeline as such, but about some broader issues of economic development in Alaska. I want to talk about economic booms in general and not just the pipeline boom that everyone is waiting for right now. Now, there are a lot of things we take for granted about economic development and about economic booms, and many of these things turn out on careful examination to be false. One truism is that an area's economic growth is directly related to the growth of its so-called basic industries, the industries that bring in outside money and by selling commodities outside, like in Alaska, like oil, timber, fisheries, or which bring in outside money for services performed here for outsiders, activities like defense and tourism. And many people believe that there is an employment multiplier for these basic industries that's very large. I recall one of our commissioners saying in a meeting a while ago that every job in mining produces 17 jobs in supporting industries. And I recall a brochure by the Alaska Visitors Association that said the same sort of thing about tourism. Well, it just ain't so. These multipliers are very difficult to measure, and they're both conceptual problems and data reliability problems, but every careful attempt to estimate the actual value of the employment multiplier for the basic industries in Alaska has come up with a figure on the order of one half of one job in the support sectors for each new job in basic industry. It's not, the multiplier is not 4 or 7 or 17, it's 1.5. In other words, one job in oil or defense activities or mining, on the average, can be expected to produce 1.5 jobs, including that first job. And this is maybe, sounds like an unpleasant thing to say, but just think about it a minute. Take a dollar of outside money that's paid in Alaska as wages to an oil industry worker or a pulp mill worker or anyone else in one of the basic industries. Just how much of that dollar stays in Alaska? Now, that's the critical question for determining the size of the multiplier. Well, first you must deduct federal income taxes, say 20%. Now, suppose that the worker spends the entire 80 cents he's got left in the state. And that's a heroic assumption because your boom industries particularly have a high proportion of transient and seasonal workers who try to take as much as they can out with them. But suppose he spends the whole 80% within the state. Let's take it 80 cents spent here for groceries. The only part of that 80 cents that stays in Alaska is some part of the retailer's markup and some part of the transportation cost, a relatively small part of the transportation cost. And so out of the 80 cents, you're lucky if you've got 30 cents that stays in Alaska the first round. Now, you can perform a similar exercise with any outlay by the firm in the basic industry for supplies, materials, services bought in Alaska. What proportion of that dollar spent here stays here for one round? And I think probably one third on the average is a pretty good approximation. Well, so a third of it's a third of that money stays in Alaska and becomes income for someone else. Okay, one job, a third of the payroll from one job will support one third of another job. And so that third is re-spent in Alaska, a third of it's re-spent in Alaska, so you get at one third plus one ninth plus 1/27 plus 1/81st, and you work it all out. And if the amount that stays here in each round is one third, the total amount that stays here after it's been spent and re-spent and re-spent again is about one half. And so the point is that the direct leverage of employment in the basic industries is not as big as people tend to believe. That a job in petroleum or in mining or in tourism or something like that does not have a tremendous leverage on the state's economy. Now, the second point I want to make about economic growth in Alaska, this is beginning to sound like a good news, bad news story, but I'm giving you the bad part of it first, I promise. The second point is that rapid economic growth in an area like Alaska that has a small population and a mobile labor force does not reduce unemployment. There was quite a flap a couple of years ago when we at the university concluded that construction of the pipeline would increase the amount of unemployment in Alaska rather than reduce it, and that the unemployment would be increased even at the peak of construction. Now, this analysis has been pretty widely accepted now. The Interior Department accepted the analysis in its impact statement. The State Department of Labor has been making the point a number of times, and I think that everybody realizes that we're going to get a big influx of people coming looking for jobs which may or may not exist. And on the average, historically, we found that the number of people coming looking for jobs pretty much balances out the number of jobs there are, except that you get them overshooting at the beginning of the boom and you get people staying on after it's over. But by and large, the thing evens out and we end up with roughly the same average level of unemployment we had before, something average on an annual average basis between 8% and 11%. And that may be there may not be anything that Alaskans can do to get average unemployment down below 8% to 11%. Everything you do to jack up the economy just brings in the people to reestablish that equilibrium. Right? But that's another topic. A local higher preference on the pipeline itself or in the industries over which the state has control won't necessarily protect the interests of local workers in this situation, because it just intensifies the competition for the jobs in the unprotected sectors of the economy. Now, we've got an excellent example of the kind of development I was talking about in the labor market in the oil boom that occurred on the Kenai in the late 1960s. The climax of development drilling in the oil and gas fields there occurred about the same time as the construction of the gas liquefaction plant, the gas-fed ammonia urea plant, the construction of the Tesoro refinery, enlargement of the Chevron refinery. And so you had a real boom that peaked in 1968. Average employment related to petroleum, including construction employment, increased from less than 200 in the early months of 1965 to a peak of almost 3,000 in 1968. It then fell steadily and finally leveled off to slightly more than 1,000 through 1970-71. During the period of increase, during the period in which employment increased by more than 10 times, unemployment increased by one half, went up from an annual average of about 400 in 1965 to about 600 in 1968. And then when the boom was over, unemployment soared to about 1,000. And by the end of 1970, there were as many people unemployed in Kenai as there were working in the oil-related industries. And over half of the people who were unemployed could be attributed directly to the boom that had gone before. So the employment impact isn't exactly the way people look at it in the first place. The third interesting observation we have to make about booms in Alaska is that there are a lot of things that they really don't affect. Average wages don't seem to be sensitive to boom conditions or to growth and recession. Now, certain bottleneck occupations, certain highly organized trades, have in effect a monopoly position, and they're able to increase their rates considerably. And you have the increase in overtime work, particularly in these occupations, but because there's no shortage of labor generally, that the bidding up, say, of certain construction trades is more than offset in most of these situations by a depressing of labor conditions in the unorganized sectors because that's where all the people who migrate in tend to focus. And you have a leveling off of, say, clerical salaries and service salaries. Interesting enough, prices in general haven't seemed to respond very much one way or another to booms. That the fear of inflation that we have with respect to the pipeline construction may not be warranted. That there's generally excess capacity in most retail and service establishments, and they can handle the increase. That you tend to get an increase in competition during these periods, and commodity prices on the whole don't get out of hand in place like Fairbanks or Anchorage. Anyway, rents are affected considerably, but in the larger communities, housing values other than land values tend not to be affected. That is, the price of houses, if you subtract the increased land value, doesn't increase during the boom period, during the period of exceptional economic growth, much faster than it does during the rest of the time. Now, land values have tended to go up very 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 rapidly, and one can say with some confidence the people who own land are the one group in the community that seem sure to benefit from extraordinarily rapid growth. By saying this, I don't urge everybody to go out and get hold of as much land as he can, because it's entirely possible that land values in the Fairbanks area have already anticipated the boom to come, and there may not be that much more to be made on it. I'm not being in the real estate business myself, I'd hesitate to make a judgment on it, but from the data we have, the land prices are the one kind of price that seems to be seriously affected by a boom. Now, the fourth point I want to make about booms and economic growth is probably the most important one. And this is the good news. Could you pass this table out here? The growth of employment, sales, and economic activity in general in the state of Alaska since the late 1960s has been very considerable. The growth of employment, of total employment in the state of Alaska, has averaged something like 7% a year, which is a fantastically good rate of growth, and it's been sustained through the whole period. It's never seriously slackened, but it has not been directly traceable to the growth of our economic base industries at all. Alaska's basic industries, and I think you all know which are the industries that bring in outside money and are the ultimate foundation of economic growth in the state, are in their order of size, their order of contribution to the state's economy. The federal government, oil and gas, wood products, and fisheries. Every one of these has been stagnant or declining in recent years. And yet the rest of the economy goes booming along in a quite healthy fashion. Oil industry spending and employment hit its peak in 1969 and has been declining ever since. Federal civilian employment also leveled off in the late 1960s. So getting back to this notion that it's the basic industries which support the rest of the economy, there's really, in the short run anyway, on a year-to-year basis, there's really little support for that notion. Now I want you to look at the table I've labeled changes in average employment. Now these figures are the percentage change in average employment in each quarter since 1969 compared with the same quarter in the previous year. That's not compared with the previous quarter, but with the same quarter in the previous year, and that way we wash out the seasonal variations. So we see whether growth has taken place over the course of the year. Now, oil and gas industry employment has declined statewide in every quarter since the first quarter of 1970, and it's now just about half of what it was in 1969. There's a remarkable pattern here that you had increases through the first quarter of 1970, and these are huge percentage decline figures, and it just keeps going down. I didn't want to give you too many numbers, but you'll find that federal employment has leveled off and sort of bounced along at the same level. Military employment has gone down, that wood products have bounced along without any clear trend during that period, since there have really been no new mills and no large sales opened up. The fisheries have been in decline the whole period. Yet, let's look at the total employment. This is non-agricultural wage and salary employment, which is the bulk of wage and salary employment in the state, and it's been increasing steadily. The fluctuation from quarter to quarter, but there's no sign whatever of any depression statewide. This is a very healthy, sustained pattern of growth, far in advance of the rate of growth in the rest of the United States, and in fact higher than that of the Pacific Coast as a whole. Employment has been increasing at an average rate of about 7% compounded through the whole period. So that the oil industry was not in any direct way the engine of growth in the state's economy. Nor was there any other industry or group of industries that you can point out that played that role. Now look at the numbers for Fairbanks. Now this labor market doesn't have substantial direct employment in petroleum, but the oil industry's impact, like the impact of federal government in the past, the impact of military here can be seen best through construction expenditures. There are a lot of people here who believe that construction is the lifeblood of the Fairbanks community and that its future depends upon getting major construction projects moving again. But here again, we see a distinct and rather steady recession in construction since early 1970. We've got only two quarters during the period in which construction employment increased over the previous year since the second quarter of 70. Unfortunately, we don't have the the data from the State Department of Labor for the whole period. But total employment in Fairbanks as a whole fell off in only two quarters, and the whole period gives us an average rate of growth of something about 6%. Now, apart from petroleum-related activity, the Fairbanks area's basic industries are the military and the university, neither of which is an adequate explanation for the very substantial and very healthy employment growth that's occurred in this region. Now, my point here is that there is a momentum of economic growth in Alaska and in the Fairbanks area that does not depend on the timing of the pipeline or of any other specific industrial development project. And that this momentum is probably more important in the growth than any specific project. These projects themselves have relatively small multipliers, but there's something else going on besides that multiplier. And one of the implications of this is that the alternation of economic euphoria and economic despair we see in this community just is not justified by the economic facts. That that we aren't really such a boom and bust subject community, and that there is a strong and continuing current of growth. Now, there are several things that keep the state's economy growing despite the decline in almost all its major basic industries. One element is, of course, the spending by the state government of bonus money that it received in 1969 from the North Slope lease sale. Sustained growth is, in this sense, an indirect effect of a pipeline and oil project that haven't been completed yet. But we can see this pattern of sustained growth unrelated to the ups and downs of the base industry before 1969. We had the same thing going on before the state had all that money in its treasury, that the military construction, that the military as a growth industry peaked out in 1956, and yet the state kept growing through the whole period. The second and probably even more important cause of this growth is the expansion and deepening of the economic support sector. As improved retail trade facilities, rapidly expanding service industries, and the substantial upgrading of the housing of Alaska residents, that the big action has not been in the basic industries, but in trade and services, and the big action in construction statewide has been residential construction rather than heavy construction or oil-related construction or military-related construction. By far the bulk of this growth, both in employment and in business receipts, both in the state as a whole and in Fairbanks, has taken place in trade and services. And so Alaska is catching up with the rest of the country, becoming a more comfortable place to live. It offers more of the amenities of modern life. And as it does all those things, a bigger proportion of each dollar received in Alaska tends to stay here and tends to turn over and stay here more on the second round. Another way of expressing this is that the employment multiplier tends to grow over time, and a small increase in the size of the employment multiplier has more leverage on total employment than a comparable increase in the number of people employed in basic industry. Now, the third and most important element in Alaska's sustained economic growth is related to the second point. The investment that's taking place in the support sector is not aimed at cleaning up a pile during a construction boom of 2 or 3 years. It's investment for the long run, and it depends upon a broad and optimistic view of the state's development opportunities. You don't amortize investment in a hotel like this, or in a shopping center, much less in a utility plant, or the paving of streets, or schools on the basis of a three-year boom and bust cycle. It was the boom and bust mentality, take the money and run, an attitude of investors toward Alaska in past years that tended to discourage permanent investment and discourage investment in amenities and the quality of life. And it's the fact that investors, whether they're Alaskans or outsiders, recognize that the economy is here to stay and that there are these basic growth forces that makes it possible to invest in something that can't be amortized for 7, 10, 15 years. Now, the major investments that do these things are long-term investments, and again, they're unrelated to the specific timing of pipeline developments, or whether there's a refinery here, or whether a mine's opened there, or whether there's a particular timber sale. And for the Anchorage area particularly, there's almost no relationship between the ups and downs in the economic base and the steady growth in the economy. The smaller the community you get, the more sensitive it is to its peculiar local industries. Fairbanks, as we've seen, is a little more sensitive to the ups and downs of construction than Anchorage. Valdez or Stevens Village or someplace, or the smaller the place you get, the more its future depends on what happens right there. But to sum up this point, which is my main point, the critical element in the state's growth and Fairbanks' growth is faith in future growth. And this faith rests in part, but only indirectly, upon the pipeline. The takeoff to sustain growth took place before the Prudhoe Bay discovery, and growth would have continued without it. If I had to name one thing that was the indispensable catalyst to Alaska's development and that guarantees that it will continue regardless what happens to specific projects, I'd pick the jet plane, which allows people to get to Alaska either for pleasure or business, and to get out of Alaska either for pleasure or for business, quickly, cheaply, and comfortably, and put this place in the world, sort of in what outsiders regard as the civilized world. But that's another story, and I think that it's one worth pursuing at some time. The two things are conspicuous guarantees of growth in the next 10 years, whenever it is that oil from Prudhoe Bay goes on stream. First is the worldwide crunch on industrial raw materials, oil, wood, minerals, and food, that's been so exasperating in the last couple years with the development of the energy crisis, the leading element in inflation being food, the pulpwood shortage, and things like this. Now, this isn't the final Malthusian rumble of doom that everybody's starving as a result of everybody starving to death. This is a product of prosperity. It's a product of undreamed of prosperity in countries with populations maybe three times ours. A Japanese economy growing at faster than 10% a year, one that will outstrip us in per capita income by 1980. A Western Europe growing at 5% a year, of West Germany and Sweden having already overtaken the United States in per capita income, and France and the rest of Scandinavia on the verge. It's a question. There are a lot of other countries that we think of as poor countries that have obviously taken off. Mexico, Brazil, Taiwan, Iran, the Arabian states, and are coming up rapidly to standards of living, if not equal to ours, in the same vicinity of ours, and coming to want to consume energy, paper, automobiles, high-quality foods, There's animal protein at levels like ours. And Alaska's latent resources then begin to come into their own. If you're talking about a doubling of the price of oil over a 4 or 5 year period, a doubling of the price of meat, a tripling of the price of whitefish blocks, that is the kind of raw material for fish sticks and this sort of thing, the economics of a lot of Alaska's remote resources changes considerably. And this looks like a very important place to begin investing, not just American capital, but of course Japanese and European capital. Now this process has been this process was inevitable, but has been accelerated fantastically by the devaluation of the dollar. The devaluation means that Alaska's potential exports cost 40% less in yen than they used to. Or on the other hand, looking at it the other way, we can command 40% more dollars out of the same yen sale that we did before. It's equivalent, that's an enormous change in the economics of what is worthwhile to produce. I think nobody's done the study yet, but I think we can probably stop complaining about the Jones Act, that in a couple of years that won't really amount to anything because the rest of the world will have caught up with our costs. Now that's the first, this worldwide demand for raw materials is a background for faith in Alaska's growth, quite apart from whether this oil development will come on this year or 10 years from now, whether that mine will open, whether the agricultural development develop here. We know that there are raw materials here that are in great demand, and some of them are going to be in very great demand. The second guarantee of sustained growth is one that not much thought is given to here, and that is the great fashion, popularity, and importance in the rest of the United States and throughout the industrialized world of wilderness, clean air, and clean water. I find the anti-wilderness and anti-environmentalist stance of a lot of traditional Alaskans is self-defeating, almost ludicrous in this context. That wilderness, clean air, and clean water will be the kind of growth resource and attraction in the next generation that sunshine has been for Southern California, Arizona, and Florida during the last generation. And although the D2 withdrawals have got to be examined and case by case, the notion that these are doing harm to Alaska's economic development, I find quite at odds with the current. It's interesting, there are three states now that have taken an officially anti-growth stance, where the political establishment, and to a certain extent the business establishment, have said, we don't want any more people, we don't want any industrial development. This is Oregon, Colorado, and Maine. And as a result of that, everybody wants to move to Oregon, Colorado, and Maine. And there are more businesses trying to get in there because they know they're going to be able to recruit and hold high-quality, skilled, and professional personnel in a place that puts the highest emphasis on preventing congestion, pollution, and things of this sort. So, my intuition is that Alaska's environmental amenities, if we preserve them and treat them right, will attract a more skilled, more prosperous, more enterprising brand of immigrant than the U.S. average of the population, and than we would otherwise. Now, I haven't got that's the end of my script, but the implications of this for development strategy in Fairbanks may be, or for Alaska, may be somewhat different from the the conventional view and from the kind of strategy that we've tended to proceed, that we probably need to focus considerably less on the individual projects. After all, as I said, the multiplier effect of a particular plant or a particular mine or a particular oil field isn't nearly as great as people seem to believe, and spend much more attention looking at the quality of life and what the community is going to look like, not just for the big boom of of next year or the following year, but 10 years in the future. And this is particularly important for Fairbanks because there is virtually nothing that has to be done in Fairbanks, as this can be a transportation junction and nothing more. The pipeline could run through here and just take everything with it. And whether or not this area grows depends more than anything else on the quality of life factors. The community, the biggest enemy to Fairbanks development with respect to EPA and the air pollution question is not EPA's inflexible or unrealistic restrictions, but the area's complacency about a real problem. And the one little thing that would do the most enormous damage to Fairbanks' long-term growth prospects would be to lose that Pan Am New York to Tokyo flight. I don't know how many of you commute outside regularly or deal with people who commute in regularly, but the existence of that one route is an enormous asset to this community and makes the decision, and well, maybe the critical issue making the decision of whether a company locates an office here at all or puts everything in Anchorage. That's another critical one. A critical handicap to growth, to attracting the footloose corporate headquarters, the talented and skilled people who will guarantee the growth here is the communications. By starving the utilities and treating the telephone system as a revenue raising device, and not having a really crash program to make sure that you can get outside or get from a call from the university downtown on the first dial, you're really, really undermining the growth prospect, because this is the kind of thing that makes the decision between Fairbanks, on which business is going to make the decision between Fairbanks and Anchorage. The zoning, planning, the paving of streets, the sewage, water and sewer, these are important things too. The psychological climate, and this may tread on some toes, but I think the whole let the bastards freeze in the dark attitude and the hostility to outsiders, outside ideas, outside advice, the notion that we've got something that's all ours and nobody better mess around with it is another obstacle to growth. Those people will come in, and the corporate presidents of resource developing companies are probably themselves members of the Sierra Club or the Friends of the Earth, and if they aren't, their wives are, and they come on the plane and they get assaulted with the kind of self-righteous hostility that this community projects, and they'll get back on it. They'll take the plane down to Anchorage and say, well, we can live here, and there are more people who feel like we do. And so, let's say, I guess the lesson is, my sermon is be a little more far-sighted and spend a little less effort trying to get that next post hole dug, and a little more in trying to develop the kind of community we want to be in and the other people are going to want to be in 10 years from now.
Thank you, Dr. Tusi. Are there any questions of Dr. Tusi? Any other comments from the floor? Hearing none, I guess we stand adjourned. Gentlemen, thank you for coming.
It was a very good talk. Very good.
We really would like to have a comment.
Yeah, okay.
Growth for growth's sake, that's out the window.
Right.